Okay, everybody, we have time for one more presentation, the title of which is For an Actor, He's a Good Ball Player, about baseball in vaudeville in the dead ball era and beyond. Please welcome R.J. Lesh.
Thank you. I am delighted and honored to be chosen to end the research presentations, to be the last one. That's such an honor. It's like being the Mariano Rivera of Sabre. This is great. Speaking of Yankees, let's dispel one myth right off the bat. Derek Jeter was not the first ball player to appear on stage in drag. It is true. He hosted Saturday Night Live, appeared in the Yankees' Wives sketch as the wife of Alfonso Soriano with his teammates, David Wells and David Cohn. But this was not a first. Now, almost 90 years earlier, Rube Marquard, the star pitcher for the New York Giants, appeared on stage in 1913 with his wife, Blossom Seeley, who is an established vaudeville singer and comedian, in a 19-minute sketch called The Suffragette Pitcher. Seeley is the manager of a Bloomer Girls type of team, right, and hires Rube to pitch for her team. So Rube is set up in a wig and a gown, goes out. They do a slide montage of him pitching in that outfit at the Polo Grounds. He comes back. They do a song and dance number. I don't have a picture to show you. Oh, how I wish I did. Susan Patrone likes to say, RJ has a thing for New York ballplayers in drag. I'm only human. This was not Marquard's first appearance on the stage, of course. Going back a year earlier, he and Seeley were on stage in a performance called Breaking the Record at Hammerstein's Victoria. I forgot to mention the Suffragette Pitcher was at the Palace. The Palace had just opened and had supplanted the Hammerstein Victoria as the vaudeville destination. They weren't in drag. He wasn't in drag. But they weren't married either, so there was a juicy scandal that erupted when they had a romance. She was married to another guy. They were caught in a hotel room in Atlantic City. Noel Hind did a whole book on it, so I won't go into detail here, but it's a juicy story. But that wasn't the first time a ballplayer appeared on stage, of course. Cap Anson and his daughters appeared in a sketch in vaudeville, obviously to mixed reviews. Bob Schaefer has written a lot about Anson's stage career. Christy Mathewson, Marquard's teammate and their catcher, Chief Myers, appeared with the actress Mae Tully in a sketch called Curves. I'll have more to say about this specific appearance later on. It's worth mentioning, though, that Myers is one of the most intriguing people in baseball to me, and I find it interesting that after just 2 years in the majors, here he is on the vaudeville stage, and you'll see what a big deal that is in a moment. And of course, the one everyone thinks of when they think of baseball and vaudeville, Mike Donlin and his wife, Mabel Height, who sort of broke the ceiling for baseball players on vaudeville, and we'll talk about why that's important in a moment. I'm not going to talk deeply on Donlin specifically, but he was the first ball player. Rob Edelman has written all about Donlin's career, but Donlin was the first ball player to be mentioned in Variety magazine, for reasons that I'll get into in a moment. So he's a trailblazer in many respects. Now you'll notice a pattern here. We have a baseball player being paired off with a vaudeville stage performer, right? Somebody who their skill set is not singing, dancing, acting, paired off with someone who's a professional in that field. Now you might ask, why would anyone do this? Why would a baseball player risk embarrassment by doing this? Why would a performer risk being shackled to somebody who, you know, this isn't their job, this could be the end of my career, right? There'd be a lot of, what's in it for either party? Well, as we'll see, what's in it for either party is a lot of cash, but there are some other benefits to this as well. I've been using the term vaudeville. I should probably explain what that means. will distinguish this from legitimate theater, which is what you'd think of as a normal theatrical performance, right? A play in multiple acts. It could be anything from Damn Yankees to Hamlet, right? It's a little more highbrow. You have a cast that's a unit that does the play and so forth. Variety theater is a little different. It's 6 to 10 independent acts that are more or less interchangeable, right? You have a juggling act, you take them out of the bill, you put in a singing act, whatever. These acts run about 15 to 30 minutes. Multiple performers, the whole bill will go about twice a day. Sometimes more often, you have had what was called continuous vaudeville, where basically when the last act was done, the next act would go in. This was great for the audience because they didn't have to show up at a particular time, right? They could just show up, pay their ticket, sit down, and just stay there, you know, for as long as they wanted to sit there, basically. Vaudeville was a term that was applied to variety theater. When they wanted to try to make it family-oriented, variety theater had this sort of stigma to it, right? Man did not take his wife and children to the variety theater. It just wasn't done. So there were a number of promoters who tried to clean up the image. They started using the term vaudeville to refer to the performance. This is in the 1870s, 1880s. Burlesque gradually took on the saucier, scantily clad women, all that sort of thing, later on. Now, it's worth mentioning what a bill looked like. I mentioned the bill. This is the one that featured Mathewson, Myers, and Tully. You'll notice the first act, here's a guy who does sand sculptures, right? And this is for good reasons. You wanted a silent act because the audience is still coming in and making noise. You didn't want an act that people could just watch without being disrupted, right? So the guy would actually, here's the San Francisco earthquake. Literally, that's what he did. The same, 15 minutes, You had acts that were in various levels of skill up to the intermission. If you weren't the headliner, you wanted to be the last act before the intermission. I don't know who McCart and Bradford were, but they must have been formidable because they're closing the first half. That was a big deal. You loved to be able to close the first half. You then work up the scale till you get to the headliners, and then you have another act that follows. The headliners weren't the last act on the bill. This goes back to, This goes back to continuous vaudeville that I mentioned earlier. You wanted to have one act on the bill that was either so boring or so bad that the audience wouldn't stick around for it more than once, and they would leave, and you could sell more tickets, right? And usually, even on the two-a-day bills, the tradition evolved that the headliner didn't go last. The last act would be the close. Is that why you guys put me last? Oh, man. All right, show must go on. In this case, though, you'll see Connolly and Wenrick were in the first half, and they also closed, probably playing the audience out as they went. So I'll go with that theory. As I mentioned, there were efforts, just as there were efforts to clean up baseball in the 1890s, after the 1890s, there were efforts to clean up vaudeville earlier than that, 1870s, 1880s, make it family entertainment. Tony Pastor and the Keith and Albee team were kind of the William Hulberts and Ban Johnsons of the vaudeville industry. They were trying to organize the industry, sometimes to the detriment of the industry, just as you could say about Hulbert and Johnson. But the efforts were to clean up the act. Keith and Albee would post lists of words you can't say, right? And if acts did say those words, they could be blacklisted. As I mentioned, baseball and vaudeville are actually evolving along parallel paths here. Richard Purick did a whole nice article on this a number of years ago. But you have a number of things that are happening here to help both of these industries, show business and sports, grow during this period, right? Technology, it's easier to get from city to city, right? So ballplayers can travel with their teams to games. Acts can go from New York to Pittsburgh and do performances along the way. So these people get tired of you. You move on to the next city. You can make arrangements in advance about where you're going next. This makes it easier to form leagues in baseball. It makes it easier for show business, theaters to organize into circuits, which is what Keith and Albie were doing. They were organizing these circuits of theaters around the country. Booking agencies were forming that would help performers get jobs, right? As performers become more popular, they're more in demand. This feeds upon itself after a while. This is what makes the partnership between the ball player and the performer desirable, right? You have this one person who wants to get out on the road and get on the road, be able to have a gig. You have these people who have some name recognition in the next city you want to visit. That helps make this an attractive partnership. I mentioned a little bit, you know, there are also some contrasts between the two. One of the key contrasts is the relationship of an audience to the performer, right? A ball player, as we mentioned, is kind of is a different skill set from a performer. The ball player is trying to focus on what he's trying to do, or she. You know, I'm trying to hit this ball, I'm trying to throw the ball, I'm trying to tune the audience out. The vaudeville audience, on the other, or the vaudeville performer, on the other hand, really wants to engage the audience, really wants to be them to like me. I want them to bring me back here next year, right? So they're trying to have a more intimate relationship with the audience. The ball player might not get that, but the performer they're teamed up with does, and that's another reason to have this pairing. You have the name recognition on the one hand, you have the someone who understands how to engage with an audience on the other. And as I mentioned, of course, all of this is driven by the cash. So how much money are we talking here? I think it always helps to put this into perspective. Average individual income around the period we're talking here, that I'm talking about here, early 1910s, you know, $800 a year. When Henry Ford decided to pay $5 a day for his assembly line workers, people thought he was nuts because there was a recession going on. He could have gotten, you know, people were saying he could get the same workers for half that. You know, it's still, Rube Marquard, who was earning $2,400 in 1911, that's still three times what the average worker was making at the time. So, you know, ball players are making some money. But you know, Mathewson, one of the top earners, $10,000. But this pales in comparison to what the vaudeville people were making. Some of the top acts, Ava Tangway or Sir Harry Lauder, could earn up to, you know, $2,000, $3,000 a week. Now, they were paying their own expenses, they're paying their own travel, they're paying stagehands and props and all this sort of thing. So it's not quite the same scale, but it's still pretty good money, and a ball player would love, you know, especially if they had the star power that Christy Mathewson had, it'd be nice to get a chunk of that, sure. This puts it in a little more perspective. I mean, the top performers are one thing, but what is the average vaudeville performer getting? This article in Variety from March 1910 talks about 300 vaudeville theaters across the country, across the U.S. and Canada. They're paying acts costing $300 a week. This is the whole bill, okay? This is all 6 to 10 of those acts that they're having that week, $300 for everybody on the bill that week. And those are the top theaters, right? This is there are about 4,000 theaters in the country doing some sort of live and vaudeville style entertainment. So these are the top dogs here. These are the ones that the ballplayers would be performing at for the most part, because they're the ones who are going to earn the high ticket costs. Just to give you an idea of where these were, here's a map of the U.S. around 1910. Here's where the major league cities are in red. The 2 years later in 1912, when we had Double A, that's where the Double A cities were. I've omitted Canada. I apologize to those of you who are from Canada. And these aren't all 300 theaters. I don't know how visible that is to you. I'm sorry, but these are some of the major circuits on there. The Keith Albee circuit was the UBO, United Booking Offices circuit, which is the blue. You'll see they pretty much dominate the East Coast. The Orpheum circuit was centered around Chicago. There are various other regional circuits. What you wanted to do as a performer was get a route with one of these circuits, right? You wanted to be able to know you're going to be in New York this week, Chicago this week, Omaha this week, that sort of thing. You wanted to have that route laid out for you. Ballplayer, who had some name recognition here in these cities, could help you get that route. So again, ballplayer gets to boost his profile, try to do some things that he couldn't do otherwise during the regular season, make some money. Performer wants to get the route and make some money. Classic example, number one. This is one of my favorites. People always ask, well, did these guys have any talent? I always kind of picture in my head the old Bob Hope specials, right? Those of you who are of a certain age and remember the Bob Hope specials, right? They'd be doing a sketch and all of a sudden, why, it's heavyweight champion George Foreman, or why, it's, you know, Joe Montana or whatever, and they'd come out, stumble over their lines, and the audience didn't care because it's George Foreman, right? And that, to some extent, that's kind of what these guys are doing, but some of these guys actually had some legitimate talent. Red Doohan is one of them. He had a very good singing voice. And here he is paired off with a guy named James McCool, who was a very famous, at the time, Irish tenor. And he was, in this sketch, paired off with Doohan, playing the father of Doohan, who is consoling him after a tough loss. Doohan has just struck out in extra innings with the bases loaded. Gee, you know, that's okay, son. They do a couple of heartfelt Irish ballads, and apparently Doohan was doing really well. Doohan was doing really well with this, and the audience, Variety reviewer, just loved him. Has a great voice, you know. Doohan is possessed of a rare tenor voice. McCool was, of course, one of the great singers of the day, according to this reviewer, and I love this. Doohan is not inflated with the idea that he is an actor. So all he has to go up there is be himself and he'll be fine, you know. So the first year the act was a little rough, but the second year they got a route, and you know, they were very excited about this. It was due entirely to the success of their efforts last season that caused the booking representatives to arrange a consecutive route. This was the dream, right? This is what you wanted to be able to do as a performer. Another one of my favorites, and not just because we're in Chicago this year, but Joe Tinker. Joe Tinker had done a melodrama the year before called A Home Run, which, as the Variety reviewer put it, barely reached first. But the next year, he went to vaudeville, and they thought that was a better deal for him. This is into that Bob Hope territory. I'll read the review that describes the act. That's kind of my holy grail, so basically, is to find reviews of these acts, and sometimes that's harder to do. But this is the review of Tinker and Sherman. The act is laid in a fourth-story apartment overlooking the Cub ballpark. The rising of the curtain discloses Sadie Sherman describing to a friend by telephone a finish fight between the Cubs and Giants. Mike Donlin hits the ball and it goes, obviously he's not on stage, but Mike Donlin hits the ball and it goes through the window of the apartment house. Tinker bursts up four flights of stairs for it. The joy-maddened crowd makes it dangerous for Tinker to leave, so he stays with the fanette and learns to act. And so they do a little sketch for the audience, in presumably in her apartment. Apparently, you'd think this would be scandalous in 1910, but the audience apparently didn't mind. Then they do a song, which was written for Tinker. Apparently, he did it well. Apparently, Tinker had a good singing voice as well. So that act toured that's off season as well, and apparently did pretty well for Tinker. But again, another Illinois performer, by the way. I enjoy this one. Am I over? 1 minute. 1 minute? Okay. Fred Beck, again, movies are starting to encroach on things, so performers would often be hired to sing while they were changing the reels in the movie theater. So Fred Beck from Havana, Illinois, his winter job was singing in these movie theaters on the movie theater circuit around Bloomington, Illinois, while they were changing the reels. Beats working in a coal mine, I think. And apparently he had a very nice singing voice as well. I'm going to have to curtail my description of Matthews and Myers, but really I could do a whole presentation on this one. Someday maybe I will. Myers, as I said, is very intriguing. Tully is also very intriguing. The sketch was written by Bozeman Bulger, but she produced it, staged it, and later went on to a reasonably successful career in the movies. She wrote seven screenplays, directed two of them, died young at the age of 40 in 1924, and it's intriguing to wonder what she might have become in the industry had she continued. Now, people, there are lots of people who have made appearances, and I have a lot of you to thank for that. Sometimes people have been doing research. They find this Paul player or that Paul player who did something, and hey, have you heard about this guy? And so I'm compiling a nice little list. So thank you. Keep those cards and letters coming. And so as we mentioned, we go on from vaudeville to, you know, if you want to reduce your workload from twice a day to, you know, once a week or less, you can always go from stage to movies or television, although here the talent is declining, you know, from, hey, I can sing a song, to, I look pretty good in a dress. Thank you all.
We have just a couple minutes for questions and answers, so if anybody has any, they should step right up.
Did you look into how much money the ball players got compared to their salaries for some of them?
You know, I kind of skipped over that. The Marquard-Seeley combination made about $1,000 a week. The Mathewson-Myers act made about $2,000 a week. Mathewson got about $1,100 of that. The rest was split among the rest of the performers, which is still a pretty good deal for everybody else. Great story is Mathewson, being sort of frugal, still took the streetcar to his performances. Myers, who was making a lot less money, decided he was going to splurge and take a cab. So I'll switch over here.
Yes, first of all, great job.
Thank you.
But second, since we're in Chicago, how was Shoeless Joe Jackson as a performer in vaudeville?
I haven't actually found a review of Jackson. I think he did some vaudeville, but I haven't found a review yet. I'll let you know once I do.
Thank you.
In 1949, Busby Berkeley directed an MGM musical called Take Me Out to the Ball Game, which portrays Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly as baseball players who are working for Esther Williams as an owner of the ball club. And it's a preposterous depiction of baseball. But I was just going to ask you what you thought of it, and are there any other films that you can think of that depict ball players as vaudevillians?
I haven't actually seen that movie yet. I'm going to have to hunt that down.
It's on DVD and on Turner Classic Movies all the time, and it's one of those films that was produced by Arthur Freed's unit at MGM.
Awesome.
It also gives Esther Williams an opportunity to do her swimming shtick and so forth. But there are a couple of very good dance numbers, and that's the idea. Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly are both dancers on the stage who are also excellent players. And Jules Munchen also is one of the players. So do catch it. It, given your research, which I hope will appear as an article or as a book soon.
I hope so, too. I will hunt that down. I did find a note once that said, surprisingly, many ballplayers are good dancers, and I thought that was an interesting comment. Yes?
Just curious if you happen to look into the career of Giants manager John McGraw and his career on the lecture circuit, because I understand that he was a frequent vaudeville made frequent vaudeville appearances, though, as just lecturing on baseball, which were interspersed with your traditional variety acts.
McGraw's act was basically stand up in front of a screen and describe, tell stories based on slides that were being projected behind him. He didn't sing or dance or anything. He also didn't want to get a route. He wanted to stay close to home. So he would do theaters here and there, but he didn't want to go on the road during the off season. He figured he had enough of that during the regular season. But yeah, his act was pretty well received, and sometimes it would compete against Marquard and Seeley, which, as their relationship altered, becomes kind of interesting.
Sounds more enlightening than Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax on Mr. Ed.
Did you find any evidence of what other players or even owners thought of these players that would participate in vaudeville? Was it like kind of, were they mocked, or did everyone else think it was kind of neat, or anything like that?
Owners were kind of fine with it. It's like they were. It wasn't a risky activity. Even in those days, they didn't want their players engaging in risky activities like winter baseball or football or anything like that. So if they were earning money on stage, the owners were pretty much okay with that.
I've just become aware recently of a clip from a 1951 Milton Berle show that has Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca doing a number together. And it's another thing you might want to try to track down if you're carrying this further with television. It's an absolutely hilarious routine, and it's very well done.
Yeah, and that's a good reminder. Vaudeville didn't die. It just kind of transformed into movie. I mean, like I said, the Ed Sullivan Show, those of us who remember some of the variety shows of the a few years ago, pretty much the same thing.
Let me just do a quickie. Andy Cohen, and you'll pardon the political incorrectness, Shanty Hogan had his act when they used to make fun of John McGraw, and when they were in New York, they called it Cohen and Hogan, and in Boston, they called it, for obvious reasons, Hogan and Cohen. John McGraw, who was being made fun of, showed up on one occasion and took part in the show. And one other thing about the movie, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, all due respect to Tinker, to Evers, to Chance, the double play combination in that was O'Brien to Ryan to Goldberg.
Oh, right. That's right. That was, I forgot about that. Anything else? Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.